Good afternoon, Your Honors. Kevin Kane for the City and County of Denver, attorney registration number 31135. At the outset, I would like to note that I intend to reserve about 5 minutes at the end of my argument for any necessary follow-up. The issue in this case really is whether the Atali Cremation Building Services established the necessary elements to prove a claim of promissory estoppel. And in particular here, whether Carnation showed reasonable reliance on alleged promises that were made by the appellant, the City and County of Denver. Under Section 91 of the Restatement Second of Contracts, where a promise is conditional, a promissor is bound only upon the occurrence of the condition. Section 91 of the Restatement was adopted in Colorado by the Supreme Court in Nelson v. LA in 1995. The conditional nature of an alleged promise precludes, as a matter of law, a claim of promissory estoppel.
So, Mr. Kane, are you saying that if the city official told the contractor, don't worry about the signature clause, just we need this work to get going, and we need to get going right now, don't worry, it will be signed, that still would be unreasonable reliance as a matter of law?
I believe it would. In this instance, there are multiple written conditions stating that this alleged promise is contingent upon the execution of an acceptable contract between the parties.
Isn't that fundamentally inconsistent with the very purposes of the doctrine of promissory estoppel?
If there is no condition, I believe it would be. And there are cases in Colorado, looking at Section 90 of the Restatement Second of Contracts, which establishes the elements of promissory estoppel, which the state of Colorado has adopted, and that is seen in light of Section 91 of the Restatement. In this instance, had there been no conditions contingent upon execution of the contract, you can withdraw at any time, this has to be approved by City Council. If none of those conditions were in place, then Section 90 would control. Here, we go a step further because there were these conditions placed on the contract, and with Section 91 of the Restatement, which says, when there's a condition, you're not bound until that condition is satisfied. So that would be the position the city would take, that there's a distinction between your average promissory estoppel claim under Section 90, and here there's an additional analysis because of the application of Section 91
So every contracting party can completely immunize themselves from promissory estoppel liability by putting the signature clause in the draft or proposed contract. Is that what you're saying?
That's not what I'm saying. Here, the conditions went beyond just a signature clause in the contract. There are multiple occasions. At first, when Carnation Building Services was notified that it was the apparent successful bidder, the letter sent to them clearly said it is subject to approval by Denver City Council, which the trial court, I might note, in looking at the responsibility of who would satisfy the condition, made no distinction between Denver's separation of powers, between the contract issued by the Department of Aviation, the legislative branch, City Council, and the executive branch, which under the Denver City Charter have to approve those contracts. Back to my point.
But this, just to be clear, this isn't a case where the city official attempted to present it to the city council for approval and the city council said no.
This is not that case. That is correct. So, leading from that point, Your Honor, the next contingency is in the RFP document itself, which in two separate places said this RFP may be withdrawn at any time and we reserve the right to reject all proposals. Secondly, it goes on to say it's contingent upon the execution of an appropriate contract. Now, Carnation Building Services, in testimony before the trial court, acknowledged, yes, those conditions were in the RFP, and yes, we were aware of them. So they had full knowledge of these conditions when they undertook all the actions that they undertook. This also goes to the point that I raised in my opening brief, the case of Colorado Department of Transportation versus First Place LLC, where a party is assumed to be aware of the contingencies in entering into a contract with a government, More specifically, the any party contracting with a government entity is presumed to be on notice of any laws that limit the contracting authority. That, again, is a contingency which, under Section 91 of their statement, precludes a claim of promissory estoppel. And I might note, I did not file a notice of supplemental authority because the case has yet to be reported. But in September of 2014, a panel of this court relied on that very principle to hold that estoppel is not permitted in a case where a party contracting with the government entity is presumed to be on notice of the laws that limit the contracting authority.
When you say it hasn't been reported, you mean it was announced as a published case, but it doesn't have a P3rd side? What do you mean not reported?
Reported, not published yet. It reads, the opinion has not been released for publication, okay. Petition for rehearing in the Court of Appeals, or a petition for certiorari in the Supreme Court may be pending.
What's the name of the case?
The name of the case is Rocky Mountain Natural Gas LLC versus Colorado Mountain Junior College District. It does not have a P3rd number.
Is that a Westlaw site?
Yes, it is 2014 Westlaw 4459269. And that was decided subsequent to the briefing in this case.
Mr. Kane?
Yes.
The requirement for city council approval and the mayor's signature on the contract.
Yes.
Those are events that are necessary to complete the formation of the contract. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And it's your argument that events such as that, which relate to the formation of the contract, such as acceptance by one of the sides, you're saying that's qualifies as a condition under Restatement 90 and Section 90 and Section 91?
Yes, I'm saying that. And there's one court in the Southern District of New York, a federal court decision that had circumstances practically identical to this, where there were two parties, a lender and a borrower, and the parties had an agreement for a contract for a financial transaction. The contract was conditioned upon reaching an acceptable contract and executing it. The party making that prompt, making that condition, who was to lend the money, decided not to enter into the contract. The first party sued for promissory estoppel, and under Section 91, the Southern District of New York, the Federal District Court, determined that that was a condition that had to be satisfied before there would be any promissory estoppel binding the second party to the contract.
But how does that argument correspond with comment C of Section 91, which seems to suggest that events which are merely a part of the contract formation, such as offer and acceptance, are excluded under the term condition under Section 91?
I apologize, my Westlaw printout does not have the comments.
Okay.
So I'll have to address that, not having read it in the past. I beg your pardon.
That's fine. Go ahead with your argument.
Restate what comment C?
Comment C to Section 91.
And again, forgive me, Your Honor, what is the comment?
It's my understanding that it excludes events which are part of the process of formation of a contract, such as offer and acceptance, from the definition of condition.
Well, I believe that this would go well beyond offer and acceptance.
When I asked you a second ago, that's what you said, that's what they were. These constituted events such as acceptance, which are essential to execution of the contract. Saying something more than that?
It is something more than that. In this case, it's the entire contracting process for the city. These conditions on it go from approval by an outside entity, that being the city council and the mayor, to actually coming to terms on an agreement and executing that agreement. So I think I might be misunderstanding your question, so I'm trying to process it and get to what it is that you would like answered.
Do you agree with your opponent that these parties have been down this road before, in the sense that there was a prior contractual relationship between the plaintiff and the defendant, Denver, and the same thing happened? In other words, work was requested to be performed or started before the formal contract was signed?
I have no personal knowledge of that, other than what the plaintiff testified. But in looking at that, I don't believe there's any testimony or evidence that was introduced to the trial court showing whether there were some conditions.
Assuming there was, would that be inconsequential to you?
I believe it would. If there are any further questions, I'll take them. Otherwise, you may request to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
You may.
Thank you, Ron.
Yes.
Good afternoon. My name is Jim Abrams, 11795. I would, as a procedural matter, ask the panel to recognize that the exhibits in this case that Denver relies on are not part of the record. We looked for those and couldn't find them. The trial court did a very thorough job in its analysis of what occurred in this case. The dispute between these parties is 7 years old next month with a local small business person saddled with equipment as a result of what happened here that he does not need. I would ask the court respectfully to note in Nelson versus Elway, I want to touch on some of the authorities mentioned by the appellant, that in the Nelson versus Elway case, that involved a third party. There was a third party involved in that case. That is not the case in this case. This was an engagement between Denver and Carnation Building Services.
Why is that significant?
Well, the court had indicated that there was, they used the word if certain things happened or if certain things occurred. These were strict conditions. There were also no prior dealings between the parties in that case, Your Honor. In first place, this is the Elway case, or excuse me, in the first place case, DOT, there was no promise. There was, the court used the word hope. It was not sufficiently specific, and the party seeking enforcement knew that it was at risk.
How do you define the promise in this case? What exactly was it?
Excuse me. Well, Your Honor, there were multiple promises in this case, as the trial court noted. It must disclose a promissory intent or constitute a commitment. This was not a single transaction. The relationship between the parties and the events at issue occurred over a substantial period of time. It wasn't a single phone call. It wasn't that these parties did not know each other. They knew each other quite well. The document, the request for proposal, was submitted according to all the procedures of the city. There wasn't anything that the appellee did not do. And that is this particular part of the promissory contract.
But I'm trying to get at, is the promise that Denver promised to sign the contract? Denver promised to pay for the trucks? Denver promised to pay for the window washing work? What exactly was the promise?
Well, by their conduct, and this is the G&L Land LLC case, it was a manifestation of Denver's intent to act or refrain from acting in a specific way. so as to justify a promise in understanding that a commitment has been made, that this contract would be actualized. And of course, the purpose, as we understand, promissory estoppel, is to give effect to promises. In the first place, the court said promissory estoppel is an extension of the basic contract principle that one who makes promises must be required to keep them. And the trial court found through extensive evidence that the conduct of the city was promissory in nature.
Mr. Abrams, I sort of want to attack Judge Berger's question from a different angle, because I'm not quite sure I understand your answer. What if, in this case, contrary to the facts of this case, but in a hypothetical situation, the Department of Aviation submitted the contract to the mayor, who signed it, submitted it to the council, but the council rejected it. And so therefore there was no official contract because the council rejected it. Would that be a violation of the city's promise to Carnation?
Well, I think there's a time issue in that pattern. The horse was already out of the barn. The city had entreated the contractor to prepare quite extensive hiring employees, showing in their office.
Well, let's assume all of that happened with your clients. You incurred all these expenses. It was coming close to the date where you were supposed to begin work, but a week before, the city council rejected the contract. Would that still be a violation of the promise, that promises you were made to acquire equipment, to begin work, to secure the bond, all of that? Would that still be a violation of the promise because the city council rejected the contract?
Yes. This promissory conduct caused all of the damages that occurred to Carnation Building Services. And the doctrine of promissory estoppel, as we understand it, is to cure the alleged contractual deficiencies, if you will. Everything that Carnation was required to do, it did do.
So how can a municipality, for that matter, any contracting party, protect themselves from liability other than liability under a contract that they have not yet signed or agreed to? Is there any way?
Yes, there is, Your Honor.
How?
The behaviors in this particular case didn't have to occur. They didn't have to, Carnation didn't have to purchase very expensive and specialized equipment, but for the fact that it was caused to have issued a live bond, which is part of the record. It was caused to issue a power of attorney to the city. The testimony from the bond representative was that there would be catastrophic consequences had Carnation not done what the city was demanding that Carnation do, and Carnation did. And this was consistent with the prior course of conduct between Carnation and the city and county of Denver. So it wasn't a matter of the city and county of Denver talking about something it had done with Greenwood Village. This is the way they do business. They cause people to engage in these undertakings, and they're quite expensive, hiring personnel, buying equipment, going into a full state of readiness. They said to them, be ready to go. These funds are encumbered. They have to be fixed by June 15th, 2008, and everything in between the award and the action of the city and county of Denver to basically say that never mind. And this is the first time, incidentally, Your Honor, this has happened in the history of Denver. It just doesn't happen.
The record reflects that?
I believe so, that it's unprecedented. And I think that the trial court used the word unprecedented, I believe.
You mean it's unprecedented for the city council or the mayor to ever reject a contract?
Well,
because you're saying that's the same situation, well, what happened here?
Your Honor, I am saying that, and I believe this is in the decision, that the city has never busted a deal and then awarded it to another bidder after it was initially awarded to one bidder. That's, I believe, the statement that's in the judge's opinion.
And then just to make sure I understand the record, the time between the award to Carnation that it was the apparent successful bidder and the time when that was rescinded, it was only about 3 weeks, is that right? 3 or 4 weeks?
Well, approximately, but during that 3 week period, it was not just a matter of doing one or two things or saying it was a successful bidder. It was these importuning conduct and entreating and basically ordering Carnation to do what it did, purchasing the equipment, be ready to go. You have to be ready to go. This has to be done. That bond that they submitted wasn't adequate on, I'll just say, day one. They required them to repair the bond. It was brought back on the next day. And at that point, it was live because Carnation had signed the documents required by the city. And it was required to sign that bond. It was required to sign the power of attorney. It did all those things. So it conducted itself in the same manner it conducted itself previously in dealing with Denver.
Are there any special limitations applicable or limiting the application of promissory estoppel to governmental entities?
Not under these facts, and no case that has been cited says that, Your Honor, that it cannot be extended to a governmental entity for the very reason of what's happened here. And I would respectfully ask the court to note that if this was not enforced, as the trial court did, they could do it again. They could do it to anybody. Have them spending thousands of dollars, basically putting them in harm's way with the forfeiture of those bonds. It was a $250,000 bond, which is in the record.
So in your view, I'll make sure I understand your view. The only way for the city to avoid liability under your theory is to, after awarding after notifying the successful bidder that they have been picked, the city must tell that bidder to do not lift a finger, do not do anything until the contract is fully executed and approved by council.
I think the sure answer is yes, Your Honor. Conversely, it's don't tell them to do anything until the document is signed. Don't engage them. Don't be involved with them, ordering them, requiring themselves to put them in financial jeopardy. And I might add, by virtue of the fact that Carnation purchased this bond, and the bond representative so testified, that had it been levied upon, it would not only have immediate catastrophic consequences, but consequences in the future when you've forfeited a bond. It did. Carnation did forfeit other work at the airport. For instance, this is in the record, the tunnel cleaning contract. Didn't bid on it, couldn't bid on it, because it was engagement was in full bloom.
Suppose your client had gone to Denver and said, I can't do anything until you give me back the signed contract. Do we know what would have happened had that been done?
Yes, Your Honor, that bond would have been forfeited, and that's why he was in harm's way.
But why? Why would the bond have been forfeited in that circumstance?
Well, the causing of him to do what he did was for the purpose of readying this engagement, and all things necessary, all things attached to the engagement had to be done. If he hadn't done them, the forfeiture of the bond would have occurred. That's why they made him get that bond, made him sign it, made them, and at that point he was powerless because he was required to give them a power of attorney. So there wasn't anything he could do to block the levying on the bond. And the bond representative made that pretty clear at trial.
Just to be clear, that Denver made it clear that Carnation had to secure a bond immediately. It couldn't wait until June 15th or whenever the start date was.
That's correct. That's correct. And it did. It did everything that was requested of it, and it did it immediately.
Did the bond have a start date? In other words, when liability on the bond would attach? Or
yes, sir.
And what was that date?
It was live when he signed it, and he signed the power of attorney. So this was just a terrible situation for the small business. And I think the classic between a rock and a hard place, he had to do it. And I think he had very good cause to do it because of the prior course of conduct between the parties. To come back to Your Honor's question concerning the promise, can be stated in words or inferred wholly or partly by conduct, and that's the Gina Land case. Carnation did meet its burden by establishing that Denver promised Carnation the award of the project. A successful bidder did all things associated with actualizing that engagement, just as it had done previously. And I think that point was not missed in the trial court, that this is the way they do business. It's a course of conduct. I can't say what they're currently doing, but was it avoidable? Absolutely, it was avoidable. They did not have to do this. This conditional argument, no request for proposal had ever been rescinded in the history of Denver. The live bond, the prior course of conduct, there wasn't any ifs. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your argument. Mr. Kane, you have a little over 4 minutes and 30 seconds. Yes, please.
Thank you. First in rebuttal, I'd like to address a few of the representations of appellee. First, in relation to the bond, counsel has stated that the bond put the appellee in jeopardy and that the representative of the surety company testified as such. What I would like to draw the court's attention to is the time the bond became effective. Counsel stated it was effective immediately, that the city of Denver could go after that bond at any time. I'm looking at the findings of fact of the trial court, and in particular, I'm looking at page 3, paragraph 16, where the court, as a finding of fact, stated Denver can enforce the performance bond at any time after it, Denver, had signed a contract. Following on that, I'm looking at the testimony of Carnation's witness, Mr. Tim Clancy. He was a representative of the surety company. And on cross-examination, Mr. Clancy was presented with the letter from Flood and Peterson Insurance delivering the bonds to Carnation. That letter stated, please note the bonds must be dated the same day that the contract agreement is signed or later. I asked him, is there any significance to that? Mr. Clancy responded, yes, it's very significant. I'm sure I can tell you all the reasons why. Okay? From our perspective, we always say that because we, if you have a bond that creates a contract, then from our understanding, it's not effective against, it's not an enforceable bond, it could be voided. That is the trial transcript, page 133, testimony of Tim Clancy, lines 6 through 15.
Mr. Kane, isn't the proper balance drawn by a rule that enforces signature or approval clauses like this, particularly when you have a public entity involved, but similarly prohibits the public entity from making inconsistent promises, inconsistent with the signature clause?
Well, again, I think there are multiple conditions, not just a signature clause. In fact, counsel testified that Carnation went and purchased these trucks at the behest of the city after they were awarded the RFP. The record reflects in testimony that Carnation was questioned about this, and under the terms of the RFP, the items that they went and purchased subsequent to award of the RFP were items that they were required to have to even be qualified to bid on the RFP. So any other bidder who bid on this RFP had the same requirements imposed on them, buying trucks. When Carnation submitted its RFP and was selected, it actually identified the equipment that it either had or would acquire. So this was a consistent requirement for all parties, even to submit a proposal. And that testimony was given by Mr. Bertram, who is the president of Carnation.
But that's a factual issue that was resolved against you, isn't it? I mean, aren't we stuck with that? I mean, you can't re-argue the facts here.
No, I believe it was established that having all those items were required in order to be qualified to bid on the proposal.
No, but the trial court found as fact that Denver did make promises that were relied upon by the contractor. Aren't we stuck with that? Aren't you stuck with that?
Well, taking that as being what the trial court decided, then it goes that extra element to the condition. And what plaintiff has argued is, and the trial court keyed in on this, and it's my position that this is where the trial court erred. On page 11 of its finding of facts and conclusions of law, it didn't disagree with Nelson DLA. It just said there has to be a third party. Now, none of the case law establishes there has to be a third party. In fact, the case from the Federal District of New York, Advanced Marine Technologies v. Boeing Securities, 16 F sub 2nd 375, is only a two-party case. The party making the promise was the person who had to satisfy the condition. They didn't satisfy that condition. Also, the illustration in Section 91 is only a two-party. That's fundamentally where the court erred. The court didn't disagree that these were conditions and that these conditions apply. They just disagreed that it could be a first party, not a third party.
Thank you, Mr. King, for your arguments. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. That concludes our oral arguments.